Well, I don't know if you've noticed in the news, but there's a bit of a leadership contest going on at the moment. Don't worry, I'm not going to delve into specifics or rights and wrongs of all that's going on. But at the moment, people are being forced to decide, aren't they? Whose side are you on? That's the question facing those who have the opportunity to vote. And just the similarities with today's passage are quite striking. There's clinging on to power, there's divisiveness, there's anger, there's promises being made, promises being broken. But that question is forced upon every character in our passage this morning. Whose side are you on? And we see that in verse 1 when Saul tells his son Jonathan and all the attendants to kill David. Everyone has to decide, will you side with David or will you side with Saul? Now, I know that you're several months into this series in 1 Samuel, and I don't want to kind of go over old ground, but just indulge me for a moment as I recap the events that have led us to this point where the king of Israel is commanding his own son to murder the greatest military leader in the nation. Now, this messy segment of Israel's history goes back a long way. But if we pick up the thread in chapter 15, that's where God instructs Saul to destroy everything that belongs to the Amalekites, a group who attacked God's people when he rescued them from Egypt. And what did Saul do? He ignored the instructions. He went and attacked the Amalekites, but his army kept the Amalekite king alive. And they kept the best of the livestock from themselves instead of destroying it as they'd been told. And so as a result, God begins a course of action to remove Saul from the throne. And David is anointed as king. Now, around the same time, Saul doesn't know David's been anointed, and he appoints him to play the lyre. Saul's having all sorts of struggles. He needs relief from an evil spirit, so a musician is called for, and David is that musician. And then when the Philistines send Goliath out to challenge Israel's soldiers, Saul and his men and his army, they cower in fear. And it's David, the musician, who trusts the Lord and steps up to win the battle. And that pattern continues with David winning battle after battle. And Saul promotes him up and up until he reaches a high rank in the army. And then Saul gets jealous when he hears the women of Israel singing David's praises. So jealous, he starts a plan, concocting a plan for David's death. He sends him on a mission carrying great risk. Does Saul's plan succeed? No, David completes the mission unharmed. And so all of this jealousy and hatred that's bubbling up inside of Saul reaches boiling point. His fear of David becomes overwhelming. He knows that the Spirit of the Lord is no longer with him, but with David. And so Saul decides to do something about it. In chapter 19, verse 1, Saul told his son Jonathan and all his attendants to kill David. And throughout chapter 19, what we're going to see is this continued outworking of Saul's jealousy and fear. He gets stuck on this slippery slope of opposition to God's purposes. He goes on an all-out offensive against God's chosen king. And so from this point on, everyone is forced to choose whose side they're on. Will they support Saul, the failing incumbent king, or will they side with the Lord and with David, his anointed one? So with that context in place, let's consider the position that Saul puts these people in and see how each of them respond. First up, we see Jonathan, who's been ordered, along with the attendants, to kill David. Now, if you remember from chapter 18, Jonathan's relationship with David is a strong one. Jonathan became one in spirit with David and loved him as himself, chapter 18, verse 1. He even gives him his robe, his tunic, his sword, his bow, his belt, royal garments, royal armor for a dear friend. And now Jonathan has to choose. Will he side with his father Saul or with his beloved friend David? Well, we see the answer right away as we continue reading verse 1. Jonathan had taken a great liking to David and warned him, "My father Saul is looking for a chance to kill you. Be on your guard tomorrow morning. Go into hiding and stay there." Jonathan's decision is made. Because if you notice, this isn't just a bit sneaky, a bit underhand from him. This is total disobedience of a clear and direct order from Saul. It's an act of treason. Jonathan was told to kill David. But here he is, warning him of the plot and urging him to go into hiding. Well, thankfully for Jonathan, he's able to go back to his father and talk him round. Explains that David has done no wrong, that his actions have benefited Saul greatly, and that God has used David to bless the whole nation of Israel. As a former pastor of mine once put it, there's only one thing more irritating than being lectured by your children, and that's being lectured by your children when they're right. Irritated or not, Saul can't argue with Jonathan's logic. So he relents, and Jonathan's deliberate disobedience to his father goes undiscovered. Whose side is Jonathan on? Jonathan chooses to go against his father and side with David. Then we have Michal, Saul's daughter and David's wife. That's right, her own father has ordered the death of her husband because of his petty jealousy. I wonder which side she'll be taking. Well, let's see. After Saul's plan to have David killed is thwarted by Jonathan, he tries to get the job done himself in verse 10. He tries to pin David to the wall with his spear, but David eludes him and runs home. I don't know if you've ever watched that program on Channel 4 called Hunted. If you're being hunted, the first place you probably don't run to is your own home. It's very easy to find you there. And Saul sends his men to watch David's house and to kill him in the morning. But clearly their surveillance training isn't up to scratch, as with Michal's help, David escapes unnoticed. Was it a cunning plan involving underground tunnels and an ingenious disguise? No, he jumps out of a window and legs it. Meanwhile, Michal grabs a spare idol, which for some reason she's got lying around the house, makes it look like David's in bed. And when the men come, she claims David is unwell, to give her husband even more time to get away. And so just like Jonathan, Michal chooses to go against her father and sides with David. Now, maybe this is starting to sound like a half-baked script to a second-rate soap opera. But don't worry, because as we come across the prophet Samuel in verse 18, there's no more sneaking around, no more deception, no more impassioned speeches or family breakdowns. But this section of the chapter is equally as dramatic. Months, if not years, have passed since we last heard about Samuel, back in chapter 16. It seems he's been keeping his head down. He's been leading a small community of prophets in a town called Naioth. And Samuel is an old man at this point. He was a prophet, a priest, and the final judge of Israel before the people decided a judge wasn't good enough. Wasn't cool enough. Now, all the other nations, they've got kings. We want a king. God knew that was a bad idea, but he gave them over to their own desires. If that's what you want, that's what you'll get, said the Lord. And that's a message repeated in Romans 1 by Paul in the New Testament. He writes about God giving people over to their sinful desires, to shameful lust, to depraved minds in accordance with the longings of their hearts. Samuel knew as well that having a king would be a bad idea. He warned the people that a king would take what was theirs for himself and for his people, for his attendants. Samuel warned the people that they would become slaves to the king. He warned them that the day would come when they would cry out for relief to the Lord, and that on that day he would not answer. And the people said, "Thank you, Samuel, we want a king." And so the Lord called Samuel to anoint the tall and handsome Saul as king. And Samuel remained by Saul's side, God's voice to the nation. It seems they developed a genuine bond. When Saul made an offering in chapter 13, Samuel rebuked him as any prophet or priest should. But when Saul disobeyed the command to destroy the Amalekites, Samuel was angry and he cried out to the Lord. And although he didn't go to see Saul again after that day, he constantly mourned for him. And here we are in chapter 19, some months and years later, and David flees and seeks Samuel out. And so another person is forced to choose whose side they're on. And in verse 18, we see that Samuel decides to take David, God's anointed king, in. They travel from the city of Ramah down to the quieter town of Naioth, where Samuel's community of prophets are living. And the meaning of the word translating prophecy here isn't particularly specific, so we're left to guess. But several commentators suggest this would include speaking God's truth, singing his praise. Something of a cross between a ministry training course and a gospel choir retreat. And so for all this time where Samuel has separated himself from Saul, the king of Israel, he's been leading this small community in worship to the Lord. Leading people in the study and teaching of God's statutes and decrees. Leading them in praise to the Almighty. And now as David comes to Saul, to Samuel, fleeing from Saul, he's invited into the fellowship. Samuel goes against the leader for whom he's been mourning and sides with David, God's anointed. So we've seen Jonathan side with David. We've seen Michal side with David. We've seen Samuel side with David. But this chapter isn't really about Jonathan or Michal or Samuel or even David. It's not here to teach us moral lessons about honesty or practical lessons in avoiding arrest. This is a chapter about God's sovereign authority and Saul's response to it. The Spirit of God has departed from Saul and now rests powerfully on David. That's what we're told in chapter 16. And what we've seen so far is Saul throwing his toys out of the pram, raging against the Lord and his new chosen king. Do you ever feel like that? When God calls you to do something or speaks into your situation through his word or through a friend, and your gut reaction is, no, that's not fair. No, that's too hard. No, I don't want to do that. Well, by this point in the story, Saul is so fiercely opposed to God's plans that he's making his family choose between David and himself. He's making them choose between God's purposes and his own. He's breaking promises. He's expending vast resources trying to find David and have him arrested, just so he can satisfy his own jealous and conceited desire to murder God's king. By this point in the story, it's going to take more than human actions to stop Saul. And so it's at this point that we need to acknowledge God's hand in all the havoc, because the Lord's been at work throughout this whole saga. Would Jonathan have got away with disobeying his father's instructions had God not enabled that meeting with David to go unnoticed? Would David have escaped through the window undetected had God not ensured Saul's men were looking the other way? Would Michal have gotten away with sticking hair on an idol in the bed if God had not dissuaded the men from investigating fully before making their report to Saul? Maybe all that evidence is a bit too circumstantial for you. I've watched enough episodes of Suits and Cavanaugh QC to know that it wouldn't stack up in court. Maybe it was just a series of fortunate events. But it's much harder to brush away the work of the Lord as we come to verse 20. David's run away, he's found Samuel, they've gone to Naioth, and Saul finds out about it. And so he sends men to capture David. Those men arrive at Naioth and they find Samuel with his band of prophets. Maybe those prophets were reflecting on the scriptures. Maybe they were discussing the future of the nation after Saul's disobedience. Maybe they were sharing words from the Lord or singing songs of worship. Whatever they were doing, as Saul's men approach, the Spirit of God comes down on them and they are led to join in. They abandon their purposes and they do God's work instead. It's probably a good few hours or even days before Saul finds out what's happened. And when he does, he sends some more men. They travel to Naioth. They find Samuel's community prophesying and they join in too. And word gets back to Saul, and so he sends some more men. As Albert Einstein probably never said, the definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over again and expecting different results. And were the results any different? No. Samuel's gospel choir just continues to grow. Every time Saul has set out to kill David, God has been able to protect him. He enabled Jonathan to warn David in verse 2. He enabled David to flee in verse 10. He made Michal's deception successful in verses 12 to 14. And now as Saul sends team after team to capture David, the Lord takes them for his own, enveloping into this community who proclaim his word and sing his praise. Every man sent to serve Saul's agenda ends up serving the Lord. So now it's Saul's turn to decide. Who will Saul serve? Will he continue to serve his own vain agenda, blinded to the fact that God is thwarting his every attempt to save face and to cling to power? Or will he bow before the King of Kings? Verse 22 says, finally, he himself left for Ramah and went to the great cistern at Seku, and he asked, where are Samuel and David? Over in Naioth at Ramah, they said. So Saul went to Naioth at Ramah, but the Spirit of God came even on him, and he walked along prophesying until he came to Naioth. He stripped off his garments, and he too prophesied in Samuel's presence. He lay naked all that day and all that night. This is why people say, is Saul also among the prophets? Once again, Saul acts according to his own agenda, and once again, God intervenes to protect his king. What stronger message could have been sent to Saul than for the Spirit to overwhelm him, causing him to proclaim the word of the God he was railing against? Did you notice that Saul didn't even make it to Naioth before the Spirit came down on him and caused him to prophesy? And when he does get there, the Spirit causes him to strip off his clothes. Saul is stripped of his royal robes. He's stripped of his royal dignity. He's stripped of his royal position. And he lies there on the floor, bare, exposed, vulnerable. Saul ordered servants to kill David and got lectured by his son. He attacked him with a spear and got it stuck in the plasterboard. He sent soldiers to surround him, but they got outsmarted by an open window and an idol in a wig. He tried to hunt David down and was overpowered by the Spirit of God. Acts chapter 4 tells us that David is the author of Psalm 2, which says, therefore, you kings, be wise. Be warned, you rulers of the earth. Serve the Lord with fear and celebrate his rule with trembling. Kiss his son, or he will be angry and your way will lead to your destruction. What a message for Saul as he lies there naked on the floor. As we reflect on this battle between Saul and the Lord, we have a warning. A warning to a world in which people oppose the gospel by denouncing the name and the character and the purposes of God. A world in which people ignore and belittle his power. A world in which people write Jesus off as just another moral teacher, or deny against all evidence and reason that he ever existed. A world in which people would rather have God's king murdered than submit to his authority. Turn with me in your Bibles to Matthew chapter 27, and we'll read a few verses which remind us of the world's attitude towards God's king. Matthew chapter 27 and verse 26. tells us that Pilate had Jesus flogged and handed him over to be crucified. Then the governor's soldiers took Jesus into the praetorium and gathered the whole company of soldiers around him. They stripped him and put a scarlet robe on him, and then twisted together a crown of thorns and set it on his head. They put a staff in his right hand. Then they knelt in front of him and mocked him. "Hail, King of the Jews," they said. They spat on him and took the staff and struck him on the head again and again. After they had mocked him, they took off the robe and put his own clothes on him. Then they led him away to crucify him. The world would rather have God's king murdered than submit to his authority. Right now, the Chinese government is rewriting the Bible to portray Jesus as a sinner so that people will bow to them rather than God's anointed king. In North Korea, Bibles are banned altogether because the truth of Jesus gets in the way of the leader's agenda. In Vietnam, new laws have just been proposed which would allow the government to clamp down on churches or even shut them down if they don't toe the Communist Party's line. In Brunei, speaking the truth about God's anointed king to a Muslim or an atheist could land you a $15,000 fine and 5 years in prison. The Iranian secret police don't just busy themselves arresting house church leaders in their own country. They are actively seeking out Persian language churches elsewhere and harassing the leaders there as well. But despite all of this, God is at work. Despite all of this, the Lord's plans will come to pass. He is in control. His hand is there in the havoc because his king sits on the throne and he will sit there for all eternity. Now, how does this apply to us today? Well, our day-to-day situation is probably not quite as dramatic as David's. And maybe our calling from God might seem rather modest compared to his. But we can be sure of God's hand in the havoc. We can be sure that when people attack us for our faith, God is in control. We can be sure that when laws are passed preventing Christians from sharing the gospel or praying for people, God is in control. We can be sure that as we do simple things for Jesus, God is in control. Jonathan warned a friend. Michal put a wig on an idol. Samuel gave David shelter. And David himself simply ran for his life. But in all those things, God was at work. God was in control. As Dale Ralph Davis puts it in his commentary, "I don't need David's experiences. I need David's God." The question this morning is, whose side are you on? For some, that might be a call to decide this morning, a call to choose between Jesus, God's anointed king, and our own agenda, our own worldly hopes and dreams and desires. If that's you this morning, I can only urge you to heed the warning that's given to Saul and to marvel at the miraculous protection given to David, God's king. Whose side are you on? But for most of us this morning, the challenge is probably not to decide, but to remember. To remember David's God. To remember the mighty power of the Lord, his sovereignty, his strength. To remember his purposes in setting apart a people for himself, in ruling over them, in placing his king Jesus on the throne. To remember his provision for every need, his presence in every trial, his promise to everyone who believes, the promise of sins forgiven, death defeated, and life to the full. In the presence of God's anointed king. I don't need David's experiences. I need David's God.